Every 5 years at Loma Linda University, the International Congress on Vegetarian Nutrition attracts scientists, doctors, dietitians, researchers, and academics from around the world. They come to share their latest discoveries and give their personal insights into a host of nutritional matters. The Go Healthy team attended the event and interviewed a number of the speakers about their area of expertise. We bring them to you during this special series on nutrition. Go Healthy for Good starts right now. Dr. Nerida, welcome to Go Healthy for Good. There's a lot to learn about nutrition and its impact on ourselves and future generations, like the relationship between the Mediterranean diet and metabolic syndrome, or how what you eat affects your great-grandchildren. Study findings from the European Prospective Investigation into Cancer and Nutrition, or EPIC, was presented at the conference. I asked Dr. Timothy Key, lead investigator from Oxford University in England, to explain the study.
Yeah, this is a study we set up 20 years ago now, recruiting people in the 1990s. And what we did was we recruited 65,000 people living throughout Great Britain, but with a special emphasis on getting as many vegetarians as possible. So about half the people don't eat meat, and among those, some are vegetarians, some eat some fish, and a smaller number are vegans. And the idea of the study is to study diet and health in general, but with a particular interest in the long-term health of vegetarians.
So what did you learn about the benefits of a vegetarian diet in terms of disease?
Well, if we look at diseases or health conditions, probably the biggest differences are less obesity in the vegetarians. And in terms of more specific diseases, we find quite a large difference in the incidence of ischemic heart disease, about 30% lower in the vegetarians than the meat eaters. For cancer, which we're also looking at, it's more complicated because there are so many different types of cancer. But at the moment, there are significantly lower risks for stomach cancer and cancers of the blood in the vegetarians.
And what about the vegan diet? Do you see differences in vegans or not?
We don't have as many vegans, so we've got enough information to look at the differences in their diet and sort of clinical characteristics, but little information yet on their longer term health. So what we see for the vegans is they're slimmer again than the vegetarians. They have lower blood cholesterol, a little bit lower blood pressure. So those are all things in a healthy direction.
Right, and that would suggest that they're at lower risk of coronary heart disease or cardiovascular disease.
Right, that's right. You would predict that the vegans would have a lower risk of ischemic heart disease than the vegetarians because of their cholesterol and blood pressure.
And ongoing follow-up, we'll see if that proves to be true. Joining us in our Loma Linda studio is Dr. Nico Reza, Assistant Professor in the Department of Nutrition at the School of Public Health at Loma Linda University. He's part of the research team involved in the Adventist Health Study. I asked him to explain metabolic syndrome.
Most are more familiar with diabetes. Metabolic syndrome is actually not a true syndrome in the true sense of the word, but it is a conglomeration of several factors, among them elevated triglyceride levels, lowered HDL levels, it has to do with glucose levels, and also waist circumference as a measure. And so it's a conglomerate of different factors which are related to your overall metabolic health.
Mm-hmm. And what is important about it? How is it relevant to the man on the street?
Well, most of it, we believe now, is driven by the obesity. And so when you are overweight, actually, so a BMI over 25 is considered to be already overweight, and you can calculate it at home. And so if you have elevated weight, And not just weight, but your overall body composition is more fat than it is muscles. And you might have a BMI that is high, but it's maybe more correlated to your strength. Maybe you are working out, but that's very, very small proportion of the population. Most of it is because of their fat that they have. But what happens is your HDL levels might be down, your total cholesterol is up, your LDL levels are up, your triglyceride levels are up. There might be some inflammatory processes going on, and so your risk of cardiovascular disease, of strokes, even of cancer are heightened. Metabolic syndrome is highly correlated with diabetes, around roughly 80% overlap.
Wow. Now, you mentioned a word in there, inflammatory processes. Mm-hmm. What's the relationship between inflammation or inflammatory processes and all of these other things that are part of this syndrome?
Well, probably some of them are driven by the same causes. An inflammatory process happens when there's maybe something not going well in the body. Maybe you have an infection and you have an inflammation. Sometimes in the arterial walls, you can have also inflammatory processes. So that's one of the theories that are behind, for example, atherosclerosis, or diseases which then can lead up to the clogging up of the arteries. So you might have an inflammatory process which maybe originally was caused or related to high cholesterol levels, maybe low HDL levels. The HDL and the LDL, they kind of transport those fats back and forth, and the HDL kind of transports it back and kind of cleanses to a certain degree. Maybe we can use that term. It's not a scientific term, but maybe let's use that. Yeah. And when you have an inflammatory process, then there is a gathering around of other antibodies. And so what can happen is that overall, there can be a clocking up. And what is interesting is what we find is there is a correlation between these factors.
Mm-hmm. And I understand also just fat itself, obesity is a very pro-inflammatory condition. Mm-hmm. So
but we should not forget, when we think about fat, and maybe some of the viewers, they cut a piece of meat and they do something and they cut away the fat, it's not just a tissue.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, when we look at it, it's not just a tissue, but it's an organ, and it can actually also release hormones. So it is an endocrinological organ. So it's not just a tissue, it's maybe not the nicest for cosmetic reasons.
A bit of ballast.
But it also releases hormones, and so it interacts with other body systems. And this is why fat is of relevance, not just in and of itself because of the weight or maybe the shape which you might like or less like, but also because of its metabolic interactions.
So from a lifestyle perspective, can we alter our risk of metabolic syndrome, or if we already have it, can we actually drive it away by the way that we live, by the diet that we eat?
Of course, everybody is different. But what we can see from epidemiological studies and some experimental studies is that there's a high correlation between lifestyle factors such as physical activity or nutrition with the metabolic syndrome. So if your diet is healthy, well, what is a healthy diet? Maybe
right.
We'll talk about it also. And if your diet is high in good foods, like, let's say, high in fiber, it is low in refined foods, it has a good overall composition with not too much fat, not too much free fats, but more complex carbohydrates, a good balance of proteins. In essence, if you go and take the fruits of the fields, you take some grains, you take your beans, your legumes, your vegetables, and make a nice wholesome food. Well, if what we find is that, for example, a Mediterranean diet, which is in essence an example of a diet that is plant-based, we find that the risk of metabolic syndrome can be lowered. And if a person suffers of it, maybe has elevated glucose levels, is maybe overweight, That's also part of the metabolic syndrome, just the weight that you have and an elevated waist circumference, by changing the diet, by changing your physical activity habits, increasing your activity, you can modulate your risk and your outcomes.
Now, I believe you've been involved in some research that looked at vegetarians versus non-vegetarians in metabolic syndrome. Who is better off there, and how much better off are they?
Well, what we looked at was vegetarians, SEMA vegetarians. These are those which occasionally eat meat, maybe more than once a month, but less than once a week. And it's always a question of definition. Maybe some would not define them as vegetarians, but what we found is that vegetarians, in comparison to non-vegetarians, had a lower prevalence of the metabolic syndrome.
How much lower?
And it was about, depending how you selected for, about maybe 40% lower.
Wow, 40%, which in the middle of this epidemic is really valuable. Coming up next, we'll show you a healthy eggplant parmesan. Don't miss it. We'll be back after a short break. Welcome back to Go Healthy for Good. Hi, Phil. How are you doing today?
Doing excellent.
Good. Hey, listen, I thought I'd have a try at poisoning, I mean cooking for you today. And I thought we'd do my favourite Italian dish, which is eggplant parmesan.
You know, if you hadn't started out that way, I'd be very excited.
Oh, really?
The whole poisoning joke. No, this sounds terrific. I'm really looking forward to it. I love eggplant parmesan.
Oh, really? So, yeah, so we're both in that boat then. Why don't you read for us what the ingredients are?
Sure. One or two eggplants, then soy milk, breading meal, olive oil, a jar of pasta sauce, and a little bit of oregano to taste. So it sounds like it's a very simple recipe.
It is. You know, stuff that comes out of a jar, as long as it's healthy, is so convenient. Although this is a little bit of a fiddle. So what we're going to do is we're going to start by slicing up our eggplant. When you cook eggplant, do you salt it and leave it to sit for a while and let all the bitterness come out? Or
you know, you actually do, because if you don't do something, it can be very bitter. And that's why a lot of people, I believe, are turned off from eggplant and may not have cooked with it very often, because it can be bitter if you don't do it right.
Right. Yeah, I'll never forget the first time my mum cooked eggplant for us. It didn't turn out right. It was a memorable experience.
It sounds like the whole family learned that lesson.
We did. We learned that one together. It was a family affair, because she went off to work. She was doing night shift, so she went off to work, leaving the dinner for Dad to serve, and he didn't think that good food should be wasted, so we had to eat it.
Oh.
Yeah. So we'll pretend that we already salted that.
Okay.
And then it'll sweat a little bit. Then we want to wash that off, drain it, and then we're going to soak it in milk and put it in the breadcrumbs. And I might put a spray on here.
And now, I've made this before, but this is a much healthier version, because you've got soy milk that you're soaking it in. And this is great. I'm looking forward to this.
Well, why don't you get started over there? We'll start with a layer of pasta sauce.
Okay.
See, that's the man's job, to get that jar open. And we'll just put a layer of that, and then you'll layer these already breaded eggplant slices.
And this is the fun part. I appreciate you letting me play with the food over here.
Oh, yeah, it's great, isn't it? Oh, that looks beautiful.
Now another layer?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, just keep on going there. You know, you can put that's soy cheese. So you can do that, or you can make a kind of a tofu ricotta cheese. But either way, you can either do it this way without the cheese at all, or put the tofu or the soy cheese in between each layer, or just keep it for the top, because it always looks pretty on top.
Okay. Well, I think I'll leave it for the top.
Okay. Oh, this looks so nice.
I am looking forward to this. You know, my friends would always make fun of me because...
Why is that?
I drove a minivan that was the exact same color of eggplant.
Did it have a name?
I called it Grimace.
Grimace?
Over the character. That's also purple.
I love it. Oh, well.
So I remember that car fondly every time I have eggplant.
So when these are cooked, and we're going to flip them, once they're brown on one side, we'll flip them over, and then we can actually add it and make that, top that one right up before you put that last layer
Okay.
on. So, do you want to dish up that, oh, that looks great. Did you need this?
That would be terrific.
So here's the finished product, and then we're going to sprinkle those herbs on top right before we bake it, so.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, this looks delicious.
Mmm.
Would you like me to serve it up?
Why don't you? Yeah.
I love the daffodils.
Oh, yeah. They're such cheerful flowers. Daffodils and daisies, they always make you smile, don't they? All right, after you.
Let's see if I can do this. Perfect.
Should I hold it?
That would be great.
And we're going to pop that in the oven, by the way, for 50 minutes at 350 degrees.
Okay. Mm. Well, it seems like it's pretty simple to do. You just kind of get it done, you pop it in the oven, and then you take care of maybe something else with the dinner.
Mm. That's right.
Mmm.
Mmm. What do you think?
That is a very good eggplant parmesan.
It's a good health that you can't tell it's that different from the real thing, can you?
No, that's incredible. Mm. I'm very impressed with that.
So you've got to try this too. Now let's watch this video.
Did you know that heart disease, the number one killer in American society, is just about totally preventable and largely reversible? And did you know that you can do more for yourself than any physician, hospital, drug, surgery to take care of this disease? We have a choice. I want to share with you what to do. What would you do if every day 10 jumbo jets would follow the sky? They would crash. Half the people would be seriously injured and the other half would be dead. Wouldn't you worry about this? Wouldn't you ask questions? Why are these jumbo jets falling out of the sky? Wouldn't you be concerned about wondering about the competency of these pilots or the control power personnel? Or wouldn't you worry about what's wrong with these aircrafts? And yet nothing is ever happening because we have become so used to hearing stories every day of 10 jumbo jets falling out of the sky that nobody even worries about anymore. And that's exactly what happens with heart disease. Every year, over 1 million heart attacks happen in the United States. And half the people are basically severely injured, and about the other half are dead. And no one seems to worry about it because it has become a way of life. People say you have to die of something. Why not a heart attack? And yet this disease is largely preventable and reversible. And all we have to do is make some simple lifestyle changes. It's almost too simple to be taken seriously. And yet you are more powerful than anyone when it comes to taking care of your heart. You are in charge. And I want to show you what to do.
Dr. Deal is right. You really are in charge of your health. Now we're back in Loma Linda with Dr. Rizzo. Before coming to Loma Linda University, he was at the Karolinska Institute in Sweden researching epigenetics. I asked him to explain epigenetics.
Epigenetics is a new field, a relatively new field, and it's a really fascinating field. We know about genetics. It's not long ago since the human genome, and probably you have heard about the Human Genome Project and Francis Crick, he was the leading scientist of it, how it went off. And we believe, well, if we know our genes and how they are made up, then we will know everything about health and disease and we can intervene. And to a certain degree, that is also true. But then we found there is something more about it. And that's what epigenetics comes into. And epi means around it. It's from the Greek word around or above the genome or the genes. Mm-hmm. And so what we have is that not all genes are expressed. To a certain extent, all of us have experienced it. And we see it continuously around it.
How do we see it, how do we experience it?
And I want to just illustrate that. Uh-huh. Imagine yourself when you were conceived. And then you have this mass of cells that are multiplying and multiplying. And then some of them become skin cells. Others become the nervous system. Others develop into the digestive system. Some of them become your eyes and organs like the kidney, the liver. But if you think about it, in each cell, you have the same genetic information.
Yes, you do.
But it is expressed in a different way.
Wow.
So your skin cells genetically have the same information as your eye cells, mm-hmm. but they are very different, I would say.
Yes.
And what we find is, and that is now where the research is focusing in, and there are different ways where you can focus on, but one particular way is to look at how can, for example, nutrition or the lack of nutrition or the excess of certain nutrients lead to differences in the expression of our genes.
So it's like your food interacts with the switch that switches the gene on or off.
Exactly.
So what sort of foods could do that?
Well, that's interesting, and that's still in the making.
Really?
But what we could maybe say is that substances that can interact and that can switch, for example, what we have seen in mice, and to a certain extent also with some studies which look retrospectively to a certain extent, where we looked, for example, the Överkalix study that was done in Sweden. Mm-hmm. Överkalix is a city far north, close to the polar circle. And what they looked at was, well, there was a period of famine in a certain region that was in Överkalix, and they compared the persons living there mm-hmm. with persons in other regions having the same nutritional, physical activity background, same population type, but they didn't suffer of a hunger period, a famine period. And then they compared, well, how does it look like then with their children and children's children? Mm. Do they develop the same diseases? How does the mortality rate look like? Similar to a study that was done with the Dutch,
The
Dutch famine. Mm. Well, interestingly, it was seen that in the Dutch famine, if you go through a hunger period during a certain time of your development, at a certain stage, then it seems you are prone for certain diseases, or you are more likely to have obesity, more likely to have diabetes.
Diabetes and cardiovascular disease,
right.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So this study was looking at similar things, but seeing if it could be passed on.
Yes, to other generations.
To further generations.
Right. What we know from animal models is that those epigenetic switches, they stay in a certain way for up to 3 and 4 generations.
Wow.
That can be, but it's not just food. It can also be environmental factors, like smoking. I call it smoking or alcohol consumption during conception, for example, and other factors which intervene with those switches, histone or methylation process. But this one switch, those methyl ends, and then if it's methylated or not, then it is either expressed the gene or it's not expressed.
Right.
And what we can see is that up to the 3rd and 4th generation, the effects of what you have done can be seen in your children, children's children, and their children. So the effects of what we do is not just important for us, but also for our descendants.
Wow. So actually our grandparents, our great-grandparents, determined our health to a certain extent.
To a certain degree.
Sean's standing by with some exercise moves for us. But first, a visit to the School of Public Health at Loma Linda University for a report on a new nutrition trial with Dr. Serena Tonstad. Dr. Tonstad, you're a professor here in the Department of Health Promotion and Education in the School of Public Health at Loma Linda. Now, I hear there's a new study come out that's very exciting. What is it? And why is it so exciting?
This is one of the most amazing studies ever published in nutrition. It's called the PREDIMED study, and it just came out in the New England Journal. It's a study of thousands of people, over 7,000 people. All of them were at high risk for heart disease. And you know, many people ask me, what should I eat? Mm-hmm. This study answers that question.
Really?
It doesn't tell you percentage of calories as fat, percentage calories as protein, but tells you which foods to eat.
Very practical.
Yeah, exactly. So these researchers in Spain took about 7,500 people. All of them were at high risk for heart disease, and they randomly divided them in three groups. And each group got a different diet. One group was the control group, mm-hmm. and they just followed some dietary advice. The other two groups had each a variant of the Mediterranean diet. I don't know what you think about when you think of Mediterranean diet.
I think of lots of fruits and vegetables and
exactly.
cereals and perhaps chickpeas, legumes.
Exactly. Yeah. That's just what it was like. So both of the groups that got the Mediterranean diet were asked to eat fruits and vegetables, mm-hmm. but they were also asked to eat sofrito. Now, sofrito is something I eat almost every day.
Really?
You take some oil, you put some garlic, and you add tomatoes, and you put it on anything. So it's a tomato sauce, a nicely flavored tomato sauce.
Any kind of oil, particular oil?
I think they made it with olive oil.
Mm-hmm.
Usually it's made with olive oil.
Okay.
And lots of good fresh herbs.
Wonderful.
And they were also asked to eat legumes, just like you said, and fish, especially fatty fish.
Mm-hmm.
And then the one Mediterranean group was asked to eat 4 tablespoons of olive oil a day. We do think of olive oil with Mediterranean diets.
We do.
Yeah.
We do.
While the other group was asked to eat 3 servings or more of nuts a week, not a day, a week.
A week.
Yeah.
Okay.
And when they compared them after several years of following them up,
mm-hmm.
let's see how long they followed them. I think it was about 5 years, just under 5 years.
Okay.
They reduced heart disease in the Mediterranean groups by 30%.
Whether they were on nuts or the sofrito?
Exactly. That's what was interesting.
Wow.
That both of those Mediterranean diets, whether you did the Mediterranean diet with the olive oil or whether you did it with the nuts, were protective.
By 30%?
30% in the course of 5 years. Just 5 years.
That's quite short for a nutrition study.
Exactly.
Isn't it?
But it's also long because many nutrition studies are just a few weeks.
Oh.
So on the other hand, this is a good study showing us that what you eat really does make a difference and telling us which foods are good.
I would think, though, 4 tablespoons of olive oil a day? A quarter of a cup of olive oil a day?
I'm wondering if it's a misprint, but that's what it says.
Yes.
Yes.
No.
And well, both of the groups ate sofrito. So tomato sauce, olive oil, nuts, in addition to your fruits and vegetables and legumes.
Well, there's nothing like eating your medicine. That's today's medical news report. Welcome back. Now, Sean is going to put us through our workout. What you got, Sean?
Well, we got our dumbbells, but let's get warmed up first.
All right.
Let's start with some jumping jacks. Let's do about 8 jumping jacks.
Okay.
All right? But we're going to do seal jacks. All right?
All right.
A little different. All right?
Okay.
Hands here, like we're praying. And the arms come out here.
Alrighty.
All right? That's how it goes. All right? So regular jumping jack, we're going to do 8 in 3, 2, and 1. Go. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. All right? Now, why you call them seal jacks?
Yeah.
SEALs and Army SEALs, Navy SEALs, they do it.
Oh, I see.
And they do them just like that. And I always admired the way they do it in you know, unison.
All in unison.
Yes. Very, very cool.
Yeah.
All right. Let's wide base.
Okay.
Hands up a little bit. And we're going to do some alternating toe touches. All right. Okay. Right hand going to the left foot.
All righty.
And then opposite. 3, 2, and 1. All the way down. All the way up. Now, why do I want to do this? Because we're going to be doing some deadlifts. And this is one great way to stretch out the hamstrings and get them warmed up.
Okay.
Make sure you're breathing, coming down. Let's do four more.
Three,
two, and one. We're gonna grab our weights. We're gonna do a deadlift to a press, okay? I love compound exercises.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, deadlift is coming here, all right? We're coming here, standing up, and then pressing back down, reverse, and here, okay? We're working our hamstring, biceps, turning it, then our shoulder, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Back down, here. So let's get into a rhythm. Go. Okay, it's a great way to burn a lot of calories with a very limited time, okay?
Yeah.
Let's do two more. I could change up the position of the hand just a little bit. All right, again, stretching out the hamstring. Coming up nice and slow, going here, rotating, and working that shoulder.
Uh-huh, slightly okay. Different.
Yeah, a little bit different. Okay, so what we're gonna do is put the weight down here with a little bit of a gap in between, okay? We're gonna put our heels right into it. This is called a hack squat. You could do your normal squat where your foot is on the floor, all right, but this changes the angle just a little bit, okay?
Right.
That's the thing about exercise. You gotta change it up so that you're not doing the same thing over and over again, okay? So we're gonna do a regular squat, but we're gonna go nice and deep, all right? Stay here. Now, this is a whole new angle. If you're used to doing the regular squat, your legs may go, what's going on? And then it may respond with a little bit of a, that burns. Okay? Let's do three more. One. Two. And three. Sweet, right? Not bad.
Nice.
Those burn. Now,
they do.
You can do those with a medicine ball in your hand.
Ooh.
But those burn. Okay?
Yep. Yep.
So the other one here is we're gonna stack them up just like this.
Ah, yep.
Let's hopefully my weights behave themselves. So you can have a seat. And I love abdominal. There you go, you just did it. You just did it. All right, so we're gonna go both sides. All right, a great way to work that abdominal area without necessarily crunching.
Right.
Okay? You can put whatever you want here, a water bottle, but you just gotta clear it, all right? Let's do four more in three, two, and one, go. One, two, three, four. Great way to work the abdominal area without working your back and, you know, too much.
Yeah.
I'll help you.
Oh, thanks.
Well, actually, you helped me up. So you work your hamstring, you work a different angle of your legs, and then you work some abdominal exercises. Now, when you're putting together your home workout, that's what you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
Work different regions of the body, okay? Especially if you want to burn calories. The hamstrings are big muscles. So if you're doing this, grab some moderate weight, all right? Not just a very light weight. Use some weight that's going to challenge your hamstrings, okay? You're gonna come down, make sure that you can curl them, okay? Here, and press.
Yep.
Okay, that will be the challenge, okay? Finding a weight that will challenge your legs, but at the same time that you can press all the
Yeah, that they won't overwhelm you and hurt your shoulders.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay?
Well, that's great.
Yeah, let's stretch it out.
Okay.
All right, nice deep breath. Inhale through your nose. Exhale through your mouth. Push your heart rate up a little bit.
A little.
You need to work a little bit harder.
Out
to the middle. Let's go to the right side. and then ease it on over to the left side, okay? We work those hamstrings. This is a great way to stretch it out back to the middle and push up and come up nice and slow,
okay? Great, thanks, Sean. That was great.
You're very welcome.
Now let's watch another Ageless Advantage spot.
Something as delicious as a palm full of cashews or a slice of whole grain toast could reduce your risk of heart disease. The Adventist Health Study found that regularly eating nuts and whole grains carries a lower risk of coronary heart disease. This is good news. Brown rice, quinoa, and hazelnuts are all flavorful, heart-healthy foods. Nuts and whole grains could keep your ticker going for many more years. Regularly consuming nuts and whole grains is another Ageless Advantage.
Thank you again for sending your questions. Here are a few. Alika posted on Facebook, I have a stiff neck, shoulder and pain deep inside my glutes. What would be the best solution? Well, Alika, I think it would be good to try some deep tissue massage, perhaps some trigger therapy, hydrotherapy, that always relaxes muscles. And if that doesn't work, maybe even see a chiropractor. Ruby texted, can vitamin D help psoriasis and can you get psoriasis inside the ear? Well, vitamin D can be taken either orally or topically as a cream. And if you're taking it orally, have about 4,000 units a day. Janet from Indianapolis asked, I have thyroid problems and I'm currently on medication, but I would like to use more holistic methods for my thyroid problems. What should I do? Well, Janet, I think it would be important to remember that thyroid disease is a little bit like diabetes in that once you have the need for insulin, you need to keep replacing that hormone. It's the same with thyroid. So if you have a need for thyroxine, then you are probably going to need to stay on it. However, you can have a good exercise program, keep your weight as normal as possible, work hard to do your best with a healthy diet, and all of those things actually will help to keep your dose down and to keep you feeling well, even though you're on thyroxine. Mabel from Louisiana asks, is psoriasis caused from allergies? Well, often there can be dietary triggers to psoriasis, like dairy, gluten, meat. Those are all common triggers. So you could try doing without them for a month or two and see if it makes a difference. And remember, if dairy is one of your triggers, you need to stay off casein, lactose, and even the smallest amounts can trigger a flare. Same with gluten. So be really vigilant during that month that you're trying off of everything. If reintroducing them makes no difference, then just eat them. Thanks for those questions. Remember, our phone number is 855-400-HEALTHY. That's 855-400-4325. You can also tweet, Facebook, email or text those questions to us. Now, before we continue the interview with Dr. Rizzo, here's today's vegetable. It's one of the first grains to be domesticated in the Fertile Crescent of Egypt and across the East. It's even depicted in Egyptian hieroglyphs. Barley is still one of the most popular cereals in the world, used for food, beverages, and animal fodder. And the word barn originally meant barley house. When selecting barley for food, the most processed form is pearl barley. Barley that's been dehulled, polished, and steam processed to remove the bran. But then there's this whole grain barley that's simply dehulled, so it still contains the bran and the germ. And finally, there's unhulled barley, covered in its inedible fibrous outer hull. You can germinate these unhulled barley seeds in just 2 or 3 days. Spread them out over the soil in a seed tray, and within a week or so you'll have a gorgeous tray of homegrown barley grass. Juiced, it's an excellent source of chlorophyll, powerful antioxidants and minerals. And you can cut 2 or 3 crops off each tray. Bon appetit. We've been discussing epigenetics with Dr. Rizzo in the Loma Linda studio. I asked him how epigenetics is changing our understanding of health and wellness.
To a certain extent, we knew about those effects, even though we didn't know about epigenetics. Maybe we didn't know even about the genes, because what we see is a difference in proteins that are being synthesized. So there's something happening also then on the genetic level. Maybe some genes are expressed more and others less. So, for example, maybe exercise might have an impact on the expression of certain genes. Maybe some genes are being switched off or on if you do certain activities, or if you smoke, or if you eat maybe not to the fullest all the time, mm-hmm. and then you become really full, and not just for a moment, but also for in other respects. And then we know that calories which are consumed in excess can have then also an influence on that. There can be also influences of certain food components, which maybe are found in soy product and other products, which can be positive mm-hmm. in reducing certain risks, maybe in not switching on certain risk genes that we might have.
So genes that might program for cancer mm-hmm. or against cancer.
Right, exactly. Wow.
Now, how important, as we're choosing our foods, how important is flavor?
Well, flavor is very important for me, having an Italian background and still eating the Mediterranean way.
Good for you.
but there is also more to it. Food needs to be an enjoyable experience. Mm. It's not all about health and counting calories and look, but it is also about an enjoyable experience that you like what you are doing and also a social experience. Right now we are socializing.
We
are having a good time talking together. Maybe the meal is missing. The right time of the day.
No.
But we should also think about it. There are flavors in connection with the foods and the colors, the flavors. They might have also some cofactors to it that are not just the flavor, but maybe they are correlated with essential oils, with polyphenols which are in it and which kind of carry some of these flavors that have a health benefit effect for us.
So what sort of foods are you thinking of? When I think flavors, I think herbs and spices. Are you thinking of those things? Do
yes.
they have an impact?
I'm also thinking of those, and I think that's a field where there is more studies needed, and some are already being done in that. In fact, during the vegetarian conference, which was being held here recently at Loma Linda, there was actually an entire session on spices and the benefits that it might have. So, for example, oregano, peppermint, or even spices that we have like ginger mm-hmm. and others, or even the lowly garlic, they might have some propensities which might help us in reducing the risk for certain diseases. I'm not speaking about healing it, but helping us in reducing the risk. And some of them might have some interaction with our genes, or overall have propensities that we don't know yet. We know all about micronutrients. Now we hear about vitamin B12, vitamin B6, folate, and the importance of it, vitamin C. But there are other substances in nature which are already there packaged and which give us also some flavor and make maybe the food more appetizing, that have not just the effect of making it more appetizing, but also benefiting
more
our
helpful.
Personal health.
So the Creator God may have actually put the chemicals in that have a flavor. We're drawn to them, and so we actually imbibe them more.
In fact,
I love that concept. That's amazing. What about, I always find if I grow my own food, it's much more flavorsome.
Since I've been working here at Loma Linda, I'm staying at a place where I can have a garden. And my father was a great gardener. He still is.
Uh-huh.
He enjoys it a lot. And he has this green thumb. And I'm not sure if I have it that way, but I planted already some foods. And I have my own herb garden.
Wow.
I have my peppermint, my oregano, and other spices. Sometimes I plant some vegetables. And it's just a different experience and taste to have your own food that you prepared and that you grew.
Absolutely. And I'd encourage our viewers to do the same. I'm with you there. We'll be back after a short break. Stay with us. And we're back. At the International Congress on Vegetarian Nutrition, we spoke with Dr. Timothy Key, lead investigator for the EPIC study, focusing on vegetarians and disease. I asked him if vegetarians have a propensity towards nutritional deficiencies.
It's a difficult question that. I mean, what we can do is estimate nutrient intakes, and we can look at blood levels of nutrients. So I suppose the things that are of potential concern for vegetarians, not very much, but blood levels of the long chain N-3 fatty acids that are usually supplied by fish are a bit lower in the vegetarians. We don't know if that matters, but they are lower. Their blood levels of vitamin B12 are a little bit lower, but again, they're probably not low enough to be any concern. And vitamin D is a little bit lower, but the levels of vitamin D are certainly above what's recommended to be healthy for Great Britain.
Now, coming to the vegans, do they show more nutrient deficiency?
I mean, as with the vegetarians, in our study, we can't really say that they're definitely deficient, but vitamin B12 levels on average are quite low in our vegans, and about half of them are below a level that would put them at, you know, you would be concerned that they might start to suffer some clinical signs. So that's the main thing, I think, to be concerned about.
Now, what about positive nutrients, positive nutrient balance? Do you see an advantage in vegetarians, vegans, in terms of nutrients that they are getting more of that are going to be good for health?
Yes, I mean, as you'd expect, really, they eat more of certain foods, obviously more fruit and vegetables, more cereals and pulses. And correlated with that, they have higher intakes of some nutrients or factors such as fibre. For example, higher potassium, higher magnesium, higher carotenoid levels, higher vitamin C. So all those things are in a direction that you would expect to be beneficial. But it's hard to be certain, you know, whether or not that it's making much difference to their health. Because the meat eaters in the study have reasonable intakes of most of these things as well.
And now back to Dr. Nico Rizzo in our Loma Linda studio. I asked him if diet and physical activity stand alone or if they are related.
We cannot just think about food and nutrition in isolation. Mm. We have to think about it in a complex and also more integrative way. So physical activity and nutrition are also correlated. Just think about it. You go home, you are maybe tired, and you sit down on your couch, and the next thing you do is you watch this program.
Yeah.
And it's a good program. And I appreciate that there are programs like this. But imagine you watch TV 1 hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, maybe more. Mm-hmm. And I'm not exaggerating. Mm-hmm. From studies, we know that people watch even more hours of TV a day. Wow. And what do you do when you're watching? Are you just watching or you're starting to grab something to eat? Maybe some snacks and maybe some potato chips and maybe not always the healthiest things, and there is also correlation there. So not only are you depriving yourself from physical activity that has its benefits in reducing overweight and in making you also more fit, and that's also an aspect I might want to mention very briefly. It is not just that we want to do physical activity to maintain our body shape. That might be a good reason, but sometimes maybe that is not so easy or it might take a long time, but we are actually increasing our physical fitness. And it has been shown that an increase in physical fitness, independent of what our body weight or BMI might be, helps us in reducing, when we spoke about a metabolic syndrome, it might reduce the risk of it, might reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease, the risk of diabetes.
Absolutely.
And so food and nutrition and physical activity are correlated. Mm. We might want to make even more healthy choices if we are doing physical activity. Maybe our mind is set to it. We are in nature, we are maybe running around, we see the green fields. We might be even inspired to eat the good things that we are seeing.
Right. And so as we choose to not do physical activity, we become more hungry, we're more likely to eat without thinking about it. Is that fair to say? But what about if we choose to be physically active? Does it change our appetite?
That might actually be that our appetite and the way we eat might also change. That, of course, needs to be studied. And I think that would be an interesting area to look at it, the interactions of how we behave, how we do physical activity, if we do exercise, if we do some gardening, but more extended one too, mm-hmm. and how that might change also our eating habits.
Right. Now, when we, if we think about TV, if we just isolate TV, the research is suggesting that when we watch TV, it's actually we burn fewer calories than if we sit and were to read our Kindle or our, you know, book or whatever, right. Sit at the computer. Is that true?
There are studies that suggest that, and it might be that our metabolic rate is a bit lower if we are watching TV. I am not too familiar with all the particular studies on it, but there is this idea that there is maybe a lower metabolic rate just by sitting and consuming instead of interactively doing something, even if you're working on your computer. If you're working on your computer, you're actually doing some little bit of physical activity.
Yes, that's true. I mean,
the definition of physical activity is movement of your skeletal muscles. And so you're doing something, even though that's not very much, but it's probably more if you're just sitting in front of your couch and you're passively consuming.
What about the how we eat, whether we're aware of what we're eating and chewing, does that change our obesity rates, our how much we eat?
There are some who are counseling that we should eat very consciously. I'm not sure if I do that all the time, but we should chew well, and we should choose our foods well. And if we choose wholesome foods, which are well packaged, so if I go and get an ice cream, that's very packaged with calories, very little nutrients beside the fat and some of the protein. And so it would be important to choose some fruits and vegetables instead.
Oh, so balance that meal out. Thank you so much for being with us today. It's been wonderful having you on the show.
A pleasure to be here.
Friends, your dietary choices are far-reaching. You are what you eat. That, combined with how physically active you are, will determine what illnesses you get or avoid. These choices will impact the health of your children and your children's children to the third generation. So the benefit of choices well made will be reaped not only by you, but your children and on down the line. Today we saw how nutrition impacts metabolism and the genes. On our next episode, we'll focus on how it affects our intellect, our thoughts and our feelings. Thanks for joining us on Go Healthy for Good. I'll see you there.